life.
Sorry we're late.
What happened?
You were looking at me.
That is true.
And I'm frantically waving.
I saw that.
Trying to get you to... Because you did not have the mic pointed at the boombox.
Did that make a problem with noise?
It wasn't bad.
Volume?
It would have been...
Was it quiet, too quiet?
It would have been better.
Should we do it again?
No. No.
Should we go take three?
We already had take one, and we're already running late and have... You know, now I'm being Dave White. Oh, we got places to go today.
You've got places to go today.
I do.
I gotta go back to bed.
Apparently so.
I'm not functioning.
Poor thing.
Well, today, it's all just because of dinner.
Well, you ate after 5:30.
My food baby misbehaved. All night long.
Okay, really, no one needs to know.
I'm feeling kind of wrung out
because this is a podcast of the cinema.
This is a Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. My name is Dave White. Goodbye. Are we done?
Stop it.
I'm a film critic with themovies.com.
You are. And I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap and a film critic at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
Oops.
And you're knocking things over.
Sorry.
This is going to be a doozy of a podcast.
I'm feeling less than optimum this morning. It's Monday morning.
Yes. We usually tape this over the weekend, but I was in Dallas for the USA Film Festival, where I go every year. And
why don't you talk all about that? Because we'll talk about all the movies you didn't see.
Well,
because
I have a really good story. I was going to save it for the end.
Oh, you want to save your really good story for the end?
Yeah.
You want to just start talking about the movies that you didn't see at all?
You
saw none of them.
I did not.
You saw zero of the movies this week.
This seemed like a good week to not have to see anything.
The cinema of this past week...
Is twiddling its thumbs
the good
and waiting
kind
for
of,
Avengers opening.
Not the good kind of the cinema. Why somebody didn't take advantage of this past weekend and open one of their good movies?
Because that good movie would then have no second weekend.
Oh, yeah. This is why I'm not in the business. Because I don't understand the decision-making of the business.
Mm.
It isn't until after that the decision is made and someone has to tell me, well, they didn't do this because of blah, blah, blah. I think, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But it never would have occurred to me. Because I just don't. But, okay.
Would have been the weekend to open a really good Maggie Smith movie.
Yes.
Because then next weekend...
It would have had an okay weekend.
It would have had an okay weekend because the Maggie Smith audience would have heard, oh, I hear that new Maggie Smith movie is so lovely. Well, everyone's going to that superhero thing. Let's go see the Maggie Smith movie.
An Age of Adeline is just going to get confused with Avengers.
The Age of Ultron.
People are going to go see Age of Adeline next weekend thinking that they're seeing the Avengers. This is going to happen.
Like when you went to see Party Girl?
Like when I went to see... In 1995, I think I've told this story once before.
I think you have.
But maybe you're a new listener to Linoleum Knife. Maybe you're not bored yet with all of our stories that we've told two and three times each. In 1995, Party Girl opened. Parker Posey. And that guy...
Guillermo Diaz.
Guillermo Diaz.
And Liev Schreiber.
Of Scandal. And Liev Schreiber. Yeah. A delightful indie film of the 90s.
Yes.
Party Girl. I went to see it opening day. First screening, Friday matinee.
Fort Worth, Texas.
There were some other people in the theater. All guys. All single, alone guys. And I thought, well, look at all these other young male Parker Posey fans.
We should go out for a Cosmo afterwards.
If only I drank Cosmos, that would be a thing that we could do. Then I was closer to the front than the back. About halfway through the movie, I think I had to go to the bathroom, but for some reason I looked around and I was alone in the theater. All those guys had left. And I thought, why did they leave? This movie's good. I'm enjoying myself with this movie. Why did they go? Well, Showgirls opened that day as well. And these chuckleheads thought they were seeing Elizabeth Berkley
licking a pole.
Licking a pole and giving one of the defining film performances of the 1990s.
Which, frankly, Parker Posey was also doing
in Party Girl.
In Party Girl.
I agree.
That was a big day in history.
Yes. So, that's my story about that.
So, yeah, so people are going to buy tickets to Age of Adeline thinking that it's Age of Ultron, and it's going to take them a good half hour because they're going to think, well, that's the girl from Green Lantern.
Do you think anyone actually thinks that? Do they look at Blake Lively and go, that's the girl from Green Lantern?
The people who are running out to see Avengers Age of Ultron on opening day, I think some of them might.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, well, let's discuss the Age of Adeline.
Let's.
Because it's the best movie that came out this week.
Okay.
That doesn't make it a good movie.
Right.
That just makes it
strictly relative.
The best movie that came out this week.
It gets an A on the bell curve.
It gets an A for a couple things. It gets an A for how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
It is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets an A plus for the costumes. Because those are... they're the kind of costumes on the kind of woman that you just want to sit there for 2 hours in the dark and go, ah, pretty lady. Like... It's, she wears clothes like very few other actresses in film. Like, she's an old-fashioned movie star-looking person.
Right.
In a way that they could have really used back in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Right.
She would have been in movies where they did nothing but put her in outfits back then.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what happens in Age of Adeline. Put her in an endless array of outfits. None of them are flashy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's interesting about this. Because her character, Adeline, born in 1908, at the age of 29, is involved in a car accident that also involves the car going underwater and the car being struck by lightning and the lightning defibrillating her, but also doing something about molecules. It's something about molecules.
Gotcha.
Her molecules stop aging. So she becomes essentially immortal.
Mm.
And then she spends the rest of the 20th century 29 years old. In the best of that century's fashions. Never anything trendy. Never anything...
Was that like a Carnaby Street moment where she's...
In 1969, where she's romancing a young man, she has a bit of a fall going on in the hair.
Okay.
Kind of a bump in the back.
Right.
And a Pucci-esque looking... headband.
Okay.
Other than that, she chooses for the rest of the 20th century to wear classically tailored ensembles. So kind of that
town and country sort of.
So that no one questions who she is. Like, it's as though, I assume the character, you know, the character Bible, whatever, would be like, she wants to blend in, she wants to fade away from what's going on around her. So everything she wears is impeccably tailored and beautifully, you know, constructed and subtle and just really elegant looking stuff.
So she's hiding in plain sight.
So she's hiding, yeah. But boy, if you're going to hide, that's a very stylish way to hide. That is what she's trying to do. She's trying to hide.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the 50s, she gets pulled over for speeding.
Mm-hmm.
And the cop looks at her and he goes, your license says you're 45. She's like, that's right.
Clean living.
And he's like, I'm going to keep your license and do a little investigating on this. And she goes on the run. Because
if you're immortal, you're also a communist.
It's also the era of the McCarthy hearings. Mm-hmm. And You know, with when Melissa McCarthy had those hearings. And she was ferreting out communism in this country. No, the FBI come looking for her because they want to do experiments on her.
Of course.
They realize there's something going on and they want to do experiments on her. So she doesn't want to be a curiosity. She doesn't want to be a freak. She doesn't want to be
vivisected,
experimented on. Yeah. So she goes on the lam and she stays that way forever, changing her decades, her identity, and her location every 10 years.
I see.
So she shows up at 29. She ages 10 years and tells everyone it's her face cream and then leaves. Along the way, in 2015, she meets a rich young philanthropist whose job in the film is to try to keep his Dutch accent from sounding American. Matthias Huis... No.
No, it's Michel.
Michel Huisman, I think is his name. He's on Game of Thrones. He's on Orphan Black. And his American accent is... passable.
American?
Yeah. And, but his main job is to get in the shower and then get out of the shower.
Gotcha.
And have a towel wrapped around his wet body.
Snug torso.
So that, yeah, so the camera can linger on his...
And Scott Eastwood.
Like, the kind of guy with too many muscles in his torso, like, you don't know where he got those from.
Right.
And... she's drawn to him. She doesn't know why she's drawn to him. Until she meets his father, Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And then realizes why she's attracted to his son.
Uh-huh.
Let's just say the guy that she's romancing in the late 60s, early 70s,
mm-hmm.
looks a lot like young Han Solo. And so that's a cool, creepy development.
Right.
Honey, I've got something to tell you, which is great because at the end, do I spoil? I don't know that I spoil.
Okay,
I
mean, maybe not.
There's a really...
look, Peter Pan shows up at the end and takes Wendy's daughter away.
I know. Maybe after we say goodbye... then I'll give the little spoiler.
If you want.
That's what I'll do. If you really want to know how this movie ends, then I'll after I say goodbye, then we'll spoil.
Okay.
I'll spoil
it. Okay.
It's corny and silly and, you know, it's like if they made Orlando for the Hallmark Channel, but with much better production values. It looks gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
She's fine. Like, she's really quiet. Very reserved through the whole film. Not overacting, not being blank or anything. In fact, she has really good scenes with Ellen Burstyn, who plays her daughter. And so there's that weird, you know, thing where, oh, I have to help my daughter find an assisted living facility.
Oh, right.
Because Ellen Burstyn is in her early 80s now.
Who plays the old daughter in Interstellar? Is that also Ellen Burstyn?
I forget.
Oh, well.
But they have really
daughters that are older than their parents.
They have really tender, affectionate moments together. That's for me is what the movie's other than the outfits. That's what the movie's about. So yeah, and don't miss, don't blink, or you'll miss the scene where she's talking about time and memory with her pet dog while eating a plate of Madeleines.
Get it?
Ha cha cha. Yeah. So it's not garbage.
Okay.
It's not good, but, you know, you go to a matinee.
All right.
And it's pretty to look at.
Speaking of fashions, I just remember there is a movie that is out now that I have seen that you haven't.
What?
Dior and I.
Oh, yeah. When did that come out? I'm sorry.
God, I hate when you do that.
Sorry, I'm yawning. It's because of my...
Yeah, but you only do it when I'm talking.
And I was up all night. Well, crazy. I'm not going to do it when I'm talking. I'm fascinated.
Perish forbid. I know that it opened Friday in Dallas because I did a Q&A with the director for opening day. I imagine it's opening in other markets as well.
It probably opened here.
It's directed by Frederick Chang, who previously, I think, was the co-director of the Deanna Vreeland documentary, The Eye Has to Travel. And also,
I saw that one.
And he produced the Valentino documentary.
Yeah, it's playing at the Arclight right now.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's also at the Burbank Media Center.
Oh, golly.
That's where I want to go.
And then go to Magnifique Mademoiselle.
That's why, yeah.
Drinking all that fashion.
I'm going to take the people who own Magnifique Mademoiselle.
To see Dior and I.
To see Dior and I. Good idea. It would be inspirational to them.
And it's funny, I went in the interview with him, he said, I'm not, like, I don't have a fashion background. I just sort of wound up doing these projects. I want to make a movie that's not about fashion.
His eye likes to travel.
Apparently so. Yeah. So this is a documentary about Raf Simons, who, Simons or Simons?
Simons, apparently. Simons?
Okay.
I was pronouncing it Rafe Simons.
It's Raf Simons.
I mean, he's been a fashion designer for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, he had his own line, and then he was with Jill Sander, and then he was like...
So the deal...
And you can tell how fashion-minded I am by the way I dress.
The deal with this movie is the story here is that he's been brought on as the new head of Dior, and so he's never done women's fashion before, he's never done couture before,
right.
And he has 8 weeks to put together a line.
Get it.
So it's all about his process and trying to figure out what he wants to do and what's inspiring him. You really get to know the seamstresses and all the people inside Dior who genuinely make all this stuff and do all the beading and, you know, the silhouettes and figure out all the stuff and make these dresses. Culminating in one of the most gorgeous runway shows I've ever seen. Like
compared to the runway show at the end of Unzipped.
It's even better.
Really?
Yeah.
Because the end of Unzipped is one of the most joyful runway shows.
No, and it's lovely. Yeah. That's a great one. But this one is even better. They construct these walls of flowers.
Yes.
Of fresh cut flowers that when you first see them on screen, I actually cried a little. Because I'm so used now to, you know, CG and green screen and everything being fake. To just see this wall of fresh cut flowers was so overwhelmingly beautiful. I couldn't take it. It's a really fascinating film. Just, you know, you feel like you've seen all this sort of behind the scenes at the couture houses, and we've talked a bunch about, you know, Signe Chanel, which is this French miniseries that aired a couple times on Sunday's channel and has never been released on video in this country, unfortunately.
You can get it if you live in other countries.
Yeah, I think it was put out on DVD in France if you have a region-free player.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has English subtitles, though. And I talked to the director about Signe Chanel, and he had seen it and was a big fan of it. But yeah, it's this cool, what they do, the reason that the title makes sense is that, you know, every time a new designer comes in to one of these big houses, they always have to sort of contend with the ghost of the original, you know, the creator. I made the joke that, you know, when you buy a Ford Motor, no one's thinking, is this how Henry would design it?
Right.
You know, but when you go to work, when you become the new face of Dior or Chanel or Yves Saint Laurent or whatever, there's some part of that, the sort of house style that you have to contend with either whether you're following along with it or fighting it or whatever. And the film has a lot of sequences that are... I don't know who reads the narration, but it's passages from the book Christian Dior and I.
Oh, okay.
Which is, you know, Christian Dior's memoir. Where
we have that book.
Yeah. I know, where he talks about himself, not himself in the third person, but he talks about himself as a regular person and himself sort of the label, you know.
Yes.
And so that is kind of intertwined with Raf's, you know, 8 week journey of trying to get this collection done. It's really great. I really highly recommend it. Even if you're, I mean, I'm so not a fashion person, but just as I do love movies where you get to see people doing their jobs,
yeah.
You know, even narrative films. Like, I remember the Draft Day was a recent example. Like, okay, I don't know what a football recruiter does, but that movie takes me through what a football recruiter does. And it's interesting to see people's jobs and how they work and what they
Moneyball,
do.
Moneyball, same.
Yeah.
A better
I mean,
example.
My God, Locke. You know, I didn't know anything about cement pours, and now I kind of do. So, yeah, I definitely recommend Dior and I. You, Dave White, should definitely see it.
Yes, because I am fashion.
You're not la mode, you're a la mode.
No, I've always had an interest in women's fashion, not men's necessarily, but women's fashion to me is like art. And because I'm a big art, because I'm a next level art bro.
Uh-huh. I was trying to think, what would a men's couture show even look like?
I don't watch them. They kind of bore me.
But do they have them?
Oh, yes, they do. But they
I mean, I know there's like men's, you know, prêt-à-porter, but are there men's couture?
I haven't seen those. I don't think those
exist. I mean, even like Van Beerendonk, that's not men's couture, right?
No. You threw me with words. I'm trying to imagine
men having to traipse around with these crazy ass, you know.
No. But even the men's ready-to-wear shows
are a little next level.
They don't bother. They don't. I'm not interested in them because they aren't. They don't inspire me. The only person who does make me happy is Walter Van Beerendonk, mm-hmm. because his stuff is like an explosion in the crazy factory, and I would never wear those clothes in a million years.
I'm taking sweatpants to a whole new place.
But I have friends who would and do. One of them is seated on our couch right now. Those are fun to look at. His clothes are art. They're fun to look at. And women's clothing, women's fashion is always interesting to look at. And you're more likely to see a woman wearing something outlandish in the street than you are a man.
Right. Although I will say,
and when you do see a man wearing something outlandish in the street, often my first response is, "Calm down."
Here's the funny thing. When I was at the USA Film Festival, Thursday night they showed Dior and I. Friday night they showed Iris, the new Albert Maysles documentary. Yes. And Iris came, by the way.
Oh, she came. She's like 90.
She's like 94.
Yeah.
Wearing a coat that was not unlike what you would see in the final runway show at Unzipped.
She
looked like an orange banana split. It was amazing.
She's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She rocked it. We'll talk about that movie next week when it opens. But anyway, all of the fashionable people of Dallas showed up for those movies
in
their ensembles.
Oh, yeah. Right on.
Like the couture kids, the avant-garde, you know.
Right, right.
The ones that are slaving away in the design district, you know, waiting for their moment.
Right. I'm Todd Oldham. Right. I buy my clothes at the Supply Sergeant.
And Target.
Not Target. L.L. Bean, mostly, mm-hmm. and... L.O. Bean and the Supply Sergeant are pretty much where my clothes
come from. No, I know. Believe me, when I was with all the fashion folks, I was like, the thing is, I go Brooks Brothers because pretty much to be a fashionable male, you either have to be whippet thin, or if you're like a big fat guy like me, you become J. McCarroll fashion clown.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got like the big fuzzy jackets and the giant orange sunglasses or whatever. It's like, that's not a look I really want to rock, so... I'll go profit.
That is not a look I want you to be in either.
Well, not to worry.
That's why I'm a good helper for you when it's time to buy clothes. I say this and not this.
Well, you know.
And you obey, and that's how it should be.
I believe it was Fran Lebowitz who said that we needed more fashion dictators in our lives. So I have you. Yeah. What else opened this week that I did not see?
Little boy.
Yeah, the trailer for this one made my teeth hurt.
The trailer for this one is full of lies. The trailer for this one.
This is another Mark Burnett, Roma Downey joint, right?
It is. And you can tell.
God loves you. My favorite line from Touched by an Angel.
You are, of course, although no one will know this, you are referencing. My old entertaining you moments of impersonating Roma Downey and Touched by an Angel. Just what I used to do a lot. I used to say to you, God knows you. God loves you.
Still makes me
laugh. I don't even know where Roma Downey is from. Is she Irish?
I believe so.
Is she actual Irish? Anthony, what is she?
You're supposed to know all the. There's only 10 people that live on that island. How can you not know this?
Let's go Irish.
Okay, she's probably Irish.
Here, Dave, you talk. I'll look it up.
Roma Downey and Mark Burnett have decided that they want to make Christian-themed films, but now I think with this one, they want to make Christian-themed films that separate them from the pack of lunatics who are also making Christian-themed films.
Yeah, she's from Derry.
Is that in Ireland?
Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, that's why she talks so funny.
That ain't English.
So they have, you can really feel them working hard here. Not, they didn't write or direct the film, but as producers, you can really feel them working hard to be like,
let's be a little middle of the road here.
Like I just said, calm down. Let's calm down.
Kirk Cameron.
So, this is about a little boy played by a kid named, oh God, what's his name? Jacob Salvati. He is seven. Mm-hmm. And he's the lead in this film. He's a cute little blonde kid. He's grown up in World War II in a town on the coast of California. A fishing town. Northern, up the coast. His mom is Emily Watson, and his father is Michael Rapaport, and his older brother is somebody I forget. The older brother has flat feet, cannot go fight in World War II, so dad goes. I don't know if that was a thing, but that's what happens here. Michael Rapaport goes, and Michael Rapaport is the little boy's only friend. The little boy's name is Pepper, but everybody calls him Little Boy because that's his nickname around town, because he's very small for his size.
I see. You mean his age?
Very small for his age, and he is teased by the local kids. They don't like him. They're mean to him. His only friend is his father. So when his father goes away to war, he's devastated. He can't function without his dad. So he goes to a magic show, and the magician, played by Ben Chaplin in a goofy mustache, he gets the kid up on stage and he's like, do you believe you can move this bottle across the table? The kid's like, I believe. And, you know, the kid puts the whammy hands on the bottle and goes, kind of grunts and groans and gurs. And the magician moves the bottle.
Right.
It is at this moment in the theater, as I'm sitting next to film critic Christy Lemire and her young, how old is he now? Four?
Four or five, yeah.
Four-year-old film critic Nick Lemire says, he did it! Which is what the kid in the movie believes, too. And that is why you are a child, because you believe these things. So the kid believes now that he has the power to move objects with his mind. And then he learns from the local priest, Tom Wilkinson, Emily Watson, both better than the material.
Well, sure.
Giving actual performances.
Yeah.
The priest, you know, is sort of like, oh, if you have the faith of a mustard seed or whatever. And the kid goes and gets a real mustard seed. And it's like, I have this faith. He's like, and this kid's like, I'm going to move a mountain. Well. To the film's credit, Tom Wilkinson has his own bottle on the desk. It's a bottle of wine. And he says, all right, if you've got faith, why don't you move this bottle? The kid huffs and puffs and, you know, does the whammy hands on the bottle. Nothing happens. Tom Wilkinson's like, try harder. Have more faith. And the kid does it again. And then Tom Wilkinson grabs the bottle and moves it across the desk and says, there, you did it. And the kid's like, you did it. And Tom Wilkinson says, no, you moved me to move that bottle. And that is what faith is.
Okay.
Which the child absolutely does not understand. Absolutely does not understand. And he wants a checklist of things that he can do to make a deal with God to get dad to come home safely from the war. And get him to swap our places.
Thank you.
Be running up that road. Running up that hill.
As soon as you said a deal with God, I couldn't stop myself.
And so the
checklist.
So the priest gives him the list of the seven corporal acts of mercy. Visit the sick, clothe the naked, feed the hungry, you know. Give drink to the thirsty, all that stuff, you know. You're Catholic.
The things that...
You know this stuff.
The things that all Christians do.
Yeah, the things that all the Christians do all the time. And that's why you know they're so great. Because they're always doing these great things for everyone. He goes and starts on his checklist. And one of the things the priest tells him to do is go make friends with the lone Japanese man in town, the one that everyone hates actually more than they hate Little Boy. Now, this movie does not pull punches about racism. Everyone in this movie is racist, except Tom Wilkinson, who plays chess with the old Japanese man.
Right.
And who kind of is his protector, because the town would, like, light his house on fire and send him packing if they could. Even the little boy is racist. Even everyone, like everyone in this movie, wants to punch the Japanese guy in the face.
And wouldn't the Japanese guy have been in an internment?
Yes, and he was, and he had been recently released from the internment.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. And so, but you know, he's like, you know, he said, "I have the face of the enemy, but I'm from here and I love this country, and you can't tell me I'm not." You know. So yeah, the movie does not goof around with the idea of what faith is and how it works. It doesn't pull punches with racism. It has stuff happening that, you know, in addition to fairly good production, fairly good, you know, plot movement and nice production values, nice, you know, period detail. Production design is really pretty. But then the thing happens. And, like, okay, well, first the kid tries to move a mountain, an actual mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously, there's an earthquake in the town because of California.
Sure.
And this just makes him think he's even got more faith.
Hmm.
Right. He tries to move Japan from the dock. Yeah. And No one will counter his thing. Everyone was like, "Well, we just had an earthquake." But what they do is they go and say, "Oh, little boy, you moved the mountain." You know, it's a little Hope and Glory in that way, or even like Life is Beautiful.
Uh-huh.
It's this child sees things the way a child would see them,
right?
And it winds up being more like Life is Beautiful than Hope and Glory. Hope and Glory is good, and Life is Beautiful is garbage. But the, so this one I'm just going to spoil. The war comes to an end, as we all know.
Spoiler.
Via the bomb on Hiroshima.
Right.
That bomb's name was Little Boy. So the newspaper prints up a big headline, "Little Boy Ends the War."
Oh, God.
And the kid runs around yelling, "Yay!" Oh.
Oh, ouch.
And the movie doesn't do a whole lot to
dissuade him.
Dissuade him or dissuade you, or like, it doesn't have a developed sense of irony at all. And it gives a passing sort of, "Oh, that was sad. Look at that devastation. The kid's so happy. Dad's coming home," you know. The movie cannot recover from this this thing.
Ugh.
And it becomes bad or worse.
How could we compare millions of dead Japanese people to one white kid getting his dad home safe?
Right. Yeah, it's you know, how many people were killed in Hiroshima? Like 100-something thousand people, you know. And I don't know exactly the numbers, but it was more than 100,000, fewer than 200,000, I believe. That's still a lot of thousands.
Yes.
And then all the millions of people who died during the war in other ways, the Holocaust and just battles and, you know. So, this movie's kind of stupid. It does not handle itself properly in the final moments. It literally drops the ball. Yeah.
And speaking of war movies that soft pedal the mass extermination of a certain group of people.
Yeah. The Water Diviner, which is the phone conversation that I imagine is Russell Crowe calls up Turkey. Someone answers. Turkey. Russell Crowe goes, "Hey, I want to make a movie. I'm Russell Crowe." And they're like, "Hooray, money." He's like, "Great, here I come." And he gets there and they say, oh, by the way, this one line that you have in the script about Armenian genocide, that's got to go. That, you take that out of your script. And Russell Crowe goes, sure, nobody will notice.
This is sheer conjecture on your part, that that one line even existed.
Yeah, we don't even know if it existed. Also, I just realized I misused the word literally, and I apologize for that. It's a movie about what happens after the battle at Gallipoli, Turkey.
Right.
Which was 100 years ago this past weekend. Hmm. Russell Crowe plays a farmer who has a gift for searching out water with those little divining rods.
Right.
He's good at that. He loses his three young sons at Gallipoli. They all go off to fight the war. And they all die. His wife, out of grief, commits suicide.
Ooh.
Yeah. So he's alone. And he promised his wife before she died that somehow he would bring them home. Even if it's just their bodies. So he decides he's going to go to Istanbul.
Not Constantinople.
Correct. To look for what remains of his sons. And he... he falls in with the Turkish nationals.
Mm-hmm.
The Turkish nationalists.
Right.
He also meets a foxy Turkish lady. Olga Kurylenko, who's not Turkish, she's French-Ukrainian. And her adorable moppet of a son. And then he goes around with the Turkish guys who fought against the Australians, the Anzacs, in Gallipoli. And he goes around and just sort of water divines for his sons, and then he finds them. Like, he has this gift of having visions that tell him where the sons are.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's no reason, no rhyme or reason for this. It's sort of like, look, I'm Russell Crowe, all right? Look at me. Have you ever seen a finer specimen of a middle-aged man in your life?
Well, it's funny, because, you know, in a way, he's...
No, you haven't.
He's kind of the later Mel Gibson in terms of the, you know, Australian... actor who, like, became a big global thing.
He's the not problematic Mel Gibson.
Right.
Other than anger management.
Yes.
Throws things at people.
But no, when you talk about this character having visions, you know, the thing about The Passion of the Christ is apparently a lot of it is based on these visions that some, like, nun had in Germany in the 14th century.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Russell Crowe has some visions.
I see.
And he finds his sons. He also goes and helps the nationalists fight the Greeks. So here's the thing. This movie does pay a lot of attention to real life war business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is not unaware of all the stuff that went on at that time. It's set in 1919. It's set 4 years after
the
Battle of Gallipoli.
Which already spawned a great Peter Weir film, Gallipoli, with Mel Gibson. It was actually Mel Gibson's breakthrough international role.
Right. So you got this movie where they really are, you know, basing it in historical fact. It's a fictional film, obviously, but they're basing it in historical fact. And it was very important. Gallipoli was super important to Australia as a nation-building event. But it just so happens that the Battle of Gallipoli began the day after the Armenian Genocide began. The day that marks the beginning of the Armenian Genocide is the 24th of April. The day that marks Gallipoli is the 25th. 4 years later, there would have been a whole lot of Armenian genociding going on in Turkey. But it's not, there's not a thing. It's just these peaceful Turks are trying their best to save their land from the interlopers and the outsiders and the English and the Australians. You know, like, it's, Armenians just don't exist in this film.
Right.
It is clear that concessions were made to the country hosting the shoot. The production was shot. They shot a lot of this in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, this is entirely speculative, but I guarantee you that somebody somewhere said, oh yeah, and this was happening too. And someone in Turkey said, oh yeah, by the way, we have a law that says you can't even talk about this.
Yeah.
And that's true. They yes. have an actual law that says you cannot discuss this.
They have another law that says you can't badmouth Ataturk.
Right. And even Ataturk, after the fact, was like, this was a shameful thing that happened yes. in this country. This is a shameful thing we have done. But it's as though there were never any Armenians in Turkey, according to this film. No mention of them ever having existed. So completely erased from the historical framework of this film. So shame on everyone involved in this movie, including Russell Crowe, who knows better and who has become visibly prickly about it in public when confronted about it. When asked about it, he becomes unhappy.
Did we mention that he directed this thing?
And he directed this, his first time director situation. He has stepped in it, probably without meaning to, probably not understanding the implications of it. But he knows now, because people are talking to him about it, and he's not happy that they're even talking to him about it. So,
and that'll make it go away.
And yes, exactly. I can't hear you. I can't hear you. So yeah, it's crap. The movie itself is regular crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a star vehicle where he gets to be sort of beatific and have actual visions
and magical.
Yeah, a lot of golden sunlight on golden
Russell Crowe,
Daddy Russell Crowe. Yeah. So, this is a bad film. Don't see it. It's historical revisionism of the worst sort. Like, if you had made a movie set in, you know,
mid-40s Poland.
Yeah, set in Poland in 1942, and it's just some, you know, family drama about, you know, whatever, and then you just never mentioned that anything was happening around you. That's what this would be. Mm. Oh, look, the dogs downstairs are howling and barking. Good morning, dogs that we hate and owners of dogs that we hate more. Hope you're listening to this podcast somehow.
I doubt it somehow.
We hate you. Just know that. We hate all of you. We hate the animals with four legs. We hate the people with two legs. Hate. Please move away.
So, anyway, I was at the USA Film Festival this week in Dallas. It was their 45th anniversary. So, they're one of the oldest, longest-running film festivals in the U.S., which is pretty amazing. I had a very interesting encounter because I think, you know, with film critics, you either wonder if your stuff is being read by the people that you're writing about.
I just wonder if my stuff's being read at all.
Or by anyone.
Not for reasons like you're describing.
No, I know.
Entirely other sets of reasons.
Yes, yes. But also just that, like, you know, I think if, say, you know, if Adam Sandler were to throw a drink in my face, you know, that would be the kind of story I would tell.
Then you could punch him back in his and it would be amazing.
He's all lawyered up.
True, you would go to prison.
But that's the kind of story that you can dine
out.
You'd
go to Funny Joke Haha Adam Sandler prison too.
Brother.
They talk about soap dropping and peepees and things like
yes,
that.
You know, yeah. And peepees. But you know, but what I'm saying though is it's a story that you can tell about how you really got under the skin of somebody you didn't like, da da da. You don't often hear film critics talking about meeting somebody who read and liked their review because the critic had said something, you know, favorable and positive.
Yeah.
It certainly never happened to me before. Maybe with some indie filmmakers, you know, like who had stuff at Sundance or whatever.
I would never be in the situation where I would be meeting those people anyway. Because if I see them in public, I turn and walk in the other direction.
But I meet them like through Outfest or something.
You were meeting them under official circumstances.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's a thing that happens sometimes. But you know, never with anybody like I would consider, you know, big and major.
Yeah.
Until now. I met Margot Martindale.
Who is great.
Who is great, and who I'm a huge fan of, and who I have gushed about in print and on What the Flick whenever we like talk about the Americans.
You gushed so much in print.
She read it.
Recently, that she read it. Yep.
I introduced myself to her. I wanted to get a picture. I never get a picture taken with the celebrities. That's like so not my thing. I'm usually like you. I'm running in the other direction. But I wanted a picture with Margot Martindale because she's Margot Martindale. She's awesome. And when she realized who I was and what I had written, namely my review of August.
And how did that come to her? How did she tell you that?
I was standing next to her. We were about to get the picture taken, and then somebody it was a cocktail party. Somebody walked up to say hi to me, and I turned and said hey. And the photographer was talking to Ms. Martindale and saying, this is Alonzo, he's a film critic. And she goes, Alonzo the film critic? And gave me a big hug. And said, and she goes, you wrote that amazing review. And I said, oh, yeah, I didn't think you'd seen it. She goes, are you kidding? Everybody I know sent me that review. My agent called me on a Saturday.
This is the review of August Osage County.
August Osage County.
Where you said that she was America's...
This generation's greatest screen actress.
This generation's greatest screen actress.
And I stand by that.
I think you're pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, she's up there.
Yeah.
Everything she's in... She's cool, even if the movie is crap.
Yeah. It's funny, because I didn't see...
Heaven... The Tom Hardy of ladies.
I didn't see Heaven is for Real, but they had a couple of clips from it in the clip
she
show.
She was the interview. Thing she in was, Heaven is for
yeah,
Real.
She was great.
Yeah.
But, I have mentioned, I'm sure, on the show a million times, if you have not seen the Margot Martindale segment of Paris Je T'aime, directed by Alexander Payne...
You must see it.
You must see it. It is an extraordinary piece of acting.
Like, you urgently must see it.
Yeah.
It's that good. And it's, what, 8 minutes long?
Something like that.
Yeah.
8 or 10. So, anyway. So, yeah, I'm a big, big fan. And I said that thing about her in the August Osage County review. Because that's a movie where so much of it doesn't work. The wrong people got Oscar nominations.
Yes.
And it's a movie that could have been a million times better in so many ways. But she nails her little corner of the world there.
Yes.
And is so great. And so she was just... It was very sweet. She knew who I was. She'd read that review. She was moved by that review.
She gave you a big hug.
She gave me a big hug. So that was kind of cool, because I adore her as an actress. And so it was very exciting to have that thing. And it just sort of made me realize now that the stuff we write, because we're writing it for, LA-based websites and, that are fairly prominent, people read them. And for the most part, we'll never hear about it because they'll either never be in the same room with us or...
Thank God.
They won't want to be in the same room with us. But, every so often, I guess, I will meet somebody who was glad I said something.
Good for you.
That was a weird moment. I mean, that will probably happen to me like 5 times over the course of my entire career, but that was the first one.
Oh, you're counting on 4 more times?
Maybe, depending on how long I live.
Who are the other 4 going to be?
I don't know. Suri Cruz. I think she's really going to... She's going to blow us away. I have no idea.
I want my 5 to be...
Okay.
Gamera.
Sure. Marissa Tomei.
Marissa Tomei. The end. That's all. Just Gamera and Marissa Tomei. Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, don't stop believing. What's your DVD pick?
Inherent Vice.
Oh, okay.
That's out this week. Coming like tomorrow. Today's Monday. Tomorrow. It's out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Inherent Vice.
I hope it comes with a chart.
You don't need a chart. You just need eyes and, internal grooviness. You need to... Yeah.
I was not a fan, but
it's incredible. What an incredible movie.
I get why people like it, and I also get why people don't.
I love it so much, and I would watch it many, many, many more times.
Mm-hmm. Great.
On DVD and or Blu-ray combo pack.
Just do that when I'm not home.
With a digital download. No, I wouldn't. Not with a digital download, because then it would be on like a phone or whatever. But I saw it in 70mm, which is the way you want to see it.
Well, la-di-da.
And,
even though it wasn't shot in 70mm.
But it was blown up beautifully and just a gorgeous movie that isn't about its action. It's about uh, Go read my review on movies.com.
Yeah, what is it about? I'm dying to know.
It's the morning. It's early. I've had no sleep.
My overwhelming memory of that
go
movie.
Go read the review.
My overwhelming movie of
we'll
that.
We'll provide a link to that review.
Fine. And my August Osage County review. My overwhelming memory of that movie is watching it in the Warner Brothers screening room next to Grey Drake. And just periodically us looking at each other like,
what's like, going on?
Is this? my DVD pick this week is Gallipoli, which is a powerful film about a horrible, you know, wartime massacre, starring a very young, pre-crazy Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Letters. Excuse me.
From Mr. Ross.
Mm-hmm.
We call him Mr. Ross. No new show for me to listen to while I work. While Alonzo is away. While Alonzo is away, the White doesn't play with electronics or have some friends over for clever conversation about the cinema. They blame you, Dave White. Eyes narrowing. Then there's a quote from a song by the Connells.
Yes.
80s guitar band.
Which I remember, actually, you and I talked about the Connells, I think, during our very first conversation.
Like the very first conversation we ever actually had, mm-hmm. face-to-face conversation?
No, on the phone.
Phone conversation? Interesting. Yeah. I don't remember that at all.
I do.
Here's the quote. All in all, it's been quite a fall, and these days are the days that I walk on. It isn't that you'll understand. If I disappointed you, I'm so sorry. You're a disappointment, too.
Well...
He's talking about you there.
No.
You're the disappointment.
You.
Anyway, it's not that bad. It's not like we don't have 5 years of back catalog to listen to. Don't let it happen again. Remember that time I was going to learn how to run the podcast without you? And then I just didn't do it.
Yeah, well, maybe whatever.
Remember that? This is from Renee.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, David Alonzo. At the beginning of a recent podcast, you speculated on how and why people listen to the podcast. For me, a great deal of the show's appeal is the conversation, which is much more stimulating than that of my circle of friends. Hey, Renee's friends.
Up your game.
Get you together. As Alonzo has remarked about certain movies, nobody I know talks that way, but I wish they did. Incidentally, this is also why I enjoy Bibbs and Whitney, in case they are listening.
Yeah.
All the best, Renee. P.S. You could eat an entire bag of chips in front of the microphone with burping noises, and it would still be preferable to another Yakov Smirnoff joke.
Now, the point of making...
Ha-cha-cha.
The point of making a Yakov Smirnoff joke is to point out that Yakov Smirnoff jokes aren't funny.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But whatever. I might take the note.
This is from Laura.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, in response to your solicitation for merch ideas... I responded by saying I thought that the idea of your faces in a grungy black and white stamp look in the style of Boondocks Saints / Scarface stuff that I've seen might look cool on a tote bag. I have since had to build myself a new computer, but I finally got around to creating a mock-up. I'm sorry I cut out... Oh, she sent us a
graphic.
A graphic. I'm sorry I cut out your hand. Alonzo, initially I thought it was just too far to the left of your
face. My hand!
To balance out Dave, but I realized my mistake until much too late. Hang on, I'm downloading this right now. I'm sure someone who actually knows what they're doing can create something better. And ideally without losing Alonzo's hand. And
my hand!
And also with a photo where you're both glaring at each other, perhaps without books. For actual merch, if nothing else, I guess there's some Linoleum Knife fan art or something. Actually, this is kind of funny.
Yeah.
So it's the photo of us reading with our faces behind books.
Yeah.
Done all black and white, and we're kind of giving each other the
stink eye,
the murder eye with the knife. As an aside, I hope you don't think I pointed out that movies.com review just to highlight and remind you of ugly homophobia. What review?
I don't know.
My review for Get Hard.
Ah.
Somebody, we talked about this.
Oh,
somebody,
she told you to read the comments?
She told me to read the comments, and then someone in the comments was like, Dave must be gay. Ew. Like this whole ridiculous, like long, you know.
Comment thread.
Just stupid, hateful, you know, stuff. And then came back and said, I didn't write any of that. My Facebook account was hacked.
Oh, that's a classic.
And I was like, that doesn't sound... That's not what hackers do. Hackers try to sell you things. Hackers are like, here's 50% off on this...
Ray-Bans.
On these Ray-Bans, yeah. While writing this, I realized... anyway, she says that she didn't make me... She didn't want to point out the homophobia, just the funny backpedaling.
Oh, okay.
Then she continues, while writing this, I realized I've been following Dave for about 10 years now, as I recall friending him on LiveJournal back in the day because of his MSNBC articles. Mm. Maybe now that I'm finally back in California, I can buy you guys lunch. I so love the idea of being bought lunch. sorry if I'm just a creepy stalker. And that's too weird. Thanks for the entertaining podcast, as well as for frequently highlighting stuff that a lot of people don't really pay attention to, and probably should, such as the mishti characterization or lack thereof of female characters, the lack of trans representation, etc., while being hilarious and awesome. Sincerely, Laura, a.k.a. Laura Organa Solo. Thank you, Laura. Great show. Great job. Wait, that's a list that we don't have time for a list this week. One moment, please, while I go back. That's another list that we don't have time for this week. Ringtones from Mr. Douglas Graves. Please, please, please make the last sign-off of bye that we did from Unfriended available as a ringtone for the upcoming subscription series. It was so sonically amazing that I immediately burst into laughter. Thank you again for the information and entertainment. All right, we're done.
All right. As always, we thank you for listening. Check out our friends on the internet, ChristyLemire.com, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, you know, the usual stuff. I'm going to make it quick because Dave has to spoil Age of Adeline. Just a quick reminder, though, of course, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, where you can please leave us a review. It does really help people find our show. You can stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or via an app on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Please go like that. Also, join the Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook and our YouTube channel. You can follow us at Twitter at LinoleumCast, and our email address is LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com, and we will very soon be recording our new Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife special episode of What's Up Doc. But in the meantime, you can PayPal us $1.99 each to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com to get our previous ones, including The Poseidon Adventure, Clue, Two for the Road, Josie and the Pussycats, and The Apple.
It makes it sound like that you want them to pay $1.99 to each of us.
No, for each episode.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So, goodbye.
That's...
Sorry, didn't mean to step on your line.
What are you doing? I'm the goodbye guy here.
You're the goodbye girl.
Goodbye. And now, it is time to spoil the Age of Adeline.
Okay.
Okay.
It involves the moon, I believe? Maybe I have that wrong.
Well, it involves more of our neighbor's dogs barking.
Obviously.
Oh, by the way. I filed a noise complaint.
Yes.
With the city.
Did anybody come to check?
Not yet. They're going to get a letter. Mm. But that's just step one of my campaign of justice.
Get him. Does Adeline get caught between the moon and New York City?
Indeed, she does. I'm going to tell you what happens to the Age of Adeline.
All right.
She gets involved. First of all, the big secret comes out with Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. Because he realizes when they were romancing in the late 60s that he was a young medical student. Mm-hmm. And they were wandering in the woods one day on a, you know, a nature, let's bang it out in the forest afternoon. She cuts her hand on a tree branch.
Ants in Our Pants, 1968.
And he has to stitch it up right there, mm-hmm. and it leaves a scar on her hand. And he sees the scar.
Oh.
Because he thinks that it's her when he first meets her, and she's like, oh, that was my mother. Yes, everyone says we look quite alike. She never uses any slang.
We
she
both
never,
use ivory dishwashing.
She never uses any slang. She never speaks as though she's part of any particular era. She's very sort of every sentence out of her mouth is
classic preppy.
Classic, yeah. And he sees the scar, and he goes outside, and he looks at the hand. He goes, "It's you." He's like, "How did this happen?" And she's like, "Crazy stuff, you know, like
funny story."
And so, meanwhile, she got it on with young Harrison Ford. Now she's enjoying the same attentions from his son,
right?
Which is the plot of many a kinky porn film.
But not this one.
But not this one. So so then she's in another car accident. Same deal. They come and get her. They rescue her. The EMTs defibrillate her. And this car accident, this magical car accident, jump starts the aging process again.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, there's a narrator who tells you all this stuff.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Emma Thompson?
No, it's the guy who narrated the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. So he has this tone of voice that's sort of like, can you even believe it? Like, that's...
The Duke boys were sure in hot water then.
Yeah. So... They set up the frame in a weird way so that when the boyfriend is about to walk in her hospital room, the camera is not giving you any entrance into her room. It's all him walking in as though there's going to be some big surprise. Mm. And I just sat there thinking, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if she turned into a 107-year-old woman right now? And then it becomes like this wacky sitcom, like, I married a 100-year-old lady!
That's the end of What We Do in the Shadows, I think.
Yeah. Which I saw while you were gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we went to see it up here at the Sundance Sunset.
Oh, funny.
That's really funny.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a really funny movie. So my fantasy of how this movie ends doesn't happen. She's still young and beautiful.
But the clock is ticking.
Yeah. So... He's like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, about the silly fight we had or whatever it was. You know? And she's like, I am ready to be with you now. And he's like, oh, that's so great. And then she says, there's just one more thing that I need to tell you. You don't see that conversation. It all comes, you know, it's all off camera. And then Ellen Burstyn walks in the room, and she's like, "Hello, I'm Jenny's friend."
Oh, brother!
And Jenny / Adeline says he knows, and so Ellen Burstyn gives him a big hug and says, "Are you my new daddy?" Yeah. She didn't say that.
But again, that's a wasted opportunity.
Look, if I were a screenwriter, this world would be a much different place. There'd be a guy marrying a 107-year-old woman, and Ellen Burstyn would be like, "Daddy," it's a young Game of Thrones guy.
So unlike Three Hearts, they actually have the conversation.
Yeah. So then they everything's great, and they're all, you know, but like the daughter moves in with them, and they're in their beautiful San Francisco apartment, and
she's in hospice.
And no, because she's now 29, but she goes to the mirror. And
Ellen Burstyn.
Ellen Burstyn's in hospice care. They pull out. She pulls out one gray hair out of her head, and that's just, and she smiles at the camera like, oh, finally, because her thing about growing old and being in love was she wanted to grow old with
someone, right?
Yeah. The end.
Okay.
It's dopey.
And yet the best new wide.
And yet the best new film of this week. Yeah. Well, other than Dior and I, which is a documentary.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, goodbye, part 2.